Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. This is our last day of Revelation to John, and this is going to be a wrap-up session. We are covering all chapters, and so I beg your patience as our members come into the Zoom meeting. We'll begin in just a moment. Good morning, everybody.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Marilyn, we're ready.
She called me. She was having trouble getting in. Then I had trouble getting in. So I'm happy to see that we both made it.
Excellent. Excellent.
For sure. For sure.
Well, I don't have any introduction today. I will say that a colleague and I were discussing actually the Revelation to John. Hey, Donna, how you doing? And one of the things he pointed out that he always says when he has to do a Bible study for it is, and I quote the Reverend Errol King, the reason that the Revelation to John was kept in the canon and part of the Bible originally was because the people at the time knew how to take it. They took it in context. They didn't take it out of context. They didn't try to think about how it would play out in the future and in their future. They understood what it meant at the time. There you have it. That is almost a direct quote from the Reverend Earl King.
So if we are listening to it, reading it and listening to it, studying it now, there's not a problem then from that point of view to making it make sense in our world today.
You know, in the ancient way of Midrash, where it's a normal cultural thing to take ancient holy scriptures and use them to help you understand your current modern life, and that people have been doing this for thousands and thousands of years in various cultures, in various religions, though Midrash does come from the Jewish tradition. There's no harm in that. Using it as a one-to-one prophecy tool, like the prophecies of Notre Dame, is where we get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is one of the most popular interpretations of the Revelation to John. So having said that little intro, the field is open, friends. What questions do you have? What comments do you have?
I have a couple questions.
All right, Sue.
As I was reviewing, I kind of went in depth on the earlier chapters because I had missed those. And then chapter 2, I guess I didn't write down the verse, but it makes in the notes, and this would mean to me that it's in the Oxford Bible notes at the bottom of the page. There's a reference to Jews who are not true Jews. And
yes,
it gives as a reference to read back on that, John 8:44. And I did go back. And then it says also, and that reference, I could not figure out what it meant. It's 1QH2.22. And I wondered, do you know what that means?
Qohelet, probably.
Pardon me?
Qohelet. QH for Qohelet.
Uh-huh.
And you're asking yourself,
what the heck is Qohelet?
What's Qohelet?
Right.
Fair question. Hey, Marilyn. So Qohelet is the Jewish name for a book in the Old Testament. And I want to make sure I don't mess it up. But I think it's Proverbs. And I say that with a caveat because I might be misremembering, because sometimes I do. So if you discover Kohelet is not Proverbs, just let me know. No problem. No skin off my nose.
Okay.
What about this issue of Jews that are not really Jews? What are they talking about?
Christians, that's not really Christians.
See, and Sue, you just put your finger on it. What we've got here is an extremely opinionated pastor. That's how we could view, even at the time, John of Patmos. You know, he's a pastor to at least these seven churches. He's in exile, which means someone didn't like his opinions very much. And someone had power and they didn't like his opinions. And he has really strong opinions when he feels people are not doing what they ought to do. You know, he calls entire societies whores of Babylon, things like this. I mean, it's loaded language he's using. And so when he references, I believe at one point he calls it the synagogue of Satan.
Yes.
And he's talking about Jews that are doing it all wrong. And he's putting a lot of moral weight on the wrongness. It's not like a little mistake. It's not like, you know, forgot to touch the little scroll at the door that proclaims that, you know, we need to hear, O Israel, God, our God is one God and there is only one God. Not like a little mistake, like a big mistake. Like they're missing the point of God in the cosmos right now. And thus they are conferring with the devil and picking the wrong side of history.
Okay.
So he's taking what he considers their mistakes and giving them cosmic weight. The kind of weight that we look back in history and say, the Holocaust, that was evil.
That was
an attempt at genocide. You know, we don't get to argue whether genocide is good or evil. That was evil. Anyone's genocide is bad. That was an attempted one. That was bad. He's looking at people's current actions of a faith that is very, very similar to his own, but not similar enough, and saying, it's just that evil. Now, of course, he's not actually referencing the Holocaust because it hadn't happened. And, you know, so we put that aside, but I bring that up as something that we can all agree is absolutely an evil act, right?
Yeah.
And so what might also be going on here is instead of John seeing an inarguably evil act and pointing it out and saying that is inarguably evil, what also might be going on is imagine the Southern Baptist Conference of Christians who got radicalized to the right a couple of decades ago. Southern Baptist Christians were not always really profoundly politically right people, right in concerns with politics. And that happened within living memory of older Southern Baptists that I have worked with. And one of the tricky things about that is now all of the leadership of that church looks at people who do things differently from them, say more liberal churches, people who vote maybe a little more left of where they vote, or maybe just a little more centrist than they vote, who don't agree with the policies that they favor, and they call them evil. Hmm. So the tricky thing is, in both of these circumstances, you have a pastor who's pointing at something and calling it evil. And with John of Patmos, you have a pastor who's pointing at something and calling it evil. And so this is a kind of caveat emptor. You as the consumer need to be aware of what you're consuming. Who is calling someone evil? Who is being called evil? Why are they being called evil? And to call someone in league with Satan, that's to call them evil. Yes. One does not dance with the devil and come out of it with perfectly white hands.
Right.
And so it's not for me to say that any particular pastor is right or wrong, but it is for all of us as consumers of information to not just think, oh, well, a pastor said it, so it must be true, but to really think, was the pastor inspired by God when they said that? Was there any kind of logic involved? Was that a reasonable response? Or was that just a totally irrational, emotional response to someone who disagrees?
You know, what you're saying applies to everything in this world. Like when you go to the internet and you read things, you have to, use judgment in what you read and whether you believe it and agree with it and whether it's true or not. I mean, there's a lot of fact checking going on with all of these politicians and news reporters and, you know, saying things that might be true or false. You don't know. You have to think before you believe. That's for sure.
Exactly.
Constantly.
Exactly. And, you know, it does help if you have your own relationship with a sense of ethics. Mm-hmm. You know, ethics are morals in action. That's my working definition for today about ethics. And so there is no such thing, I don't believe, of a human being walking on earth who is not as enlightened as Jesus was. Mm-hmm. Who has no space at all in their lives between what they say they do and think and what they actually do. Even for the best of us, there's always at least a little bit of a space where we fail. We don't measure up. And whether or not we make it clear to other people, or whether that's just a private thing that we hold on to with grace or difficulty, there is always a space between what we say and what we actually will end up doing, between what we think and what we actually end up doing. The tricky thing is here, the goal is to make that space an ever decreasing one, rather than to make that space an ever increasing one. And to make it an increasing one is to be a hypocrite. And to make it a decreasing one is to have integrity without being perfect. No one is a perfect hypocrite and no one has perfect integrity because we are all broken creatures. Mm-hmm. Marilyn?
I think we have to evaluate what John is saying, certainly. But John, too, is entitled to his opinion, and he not only is entitled to it, but I'm sure he felt what he wrote, what he did, or whatever, said what he did, that he believed it, and he was carrying out his responsibility to other people, whether it's right or wrong. He felt that it was right, and so I think that's something to bear in mind, although the taking of it literally it's our responsibility to do that or not.
And he has a really beautiful and helpful turn of phrase over and over again. And it's not just the images that he sees, it's how he's seeing them and how he's communicating them. I was talking with a colleague yesterday about what he says of Laodicea. And he tells them that they are neither hot nor cold.
Right.
They are neither cold nor hot. And if they were either hot or cold, that would be easier to take. But since they are lukewarm, he is going to spit them out of his mouth. And I don't know about you, but I've known people like that. Like, for the love of God, would you just pick something and be passionate about it, won't you? You know, even if you're wrong, just try.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are moments I'm like, oh, John, I feel you, buddy. I feel you.
Yeah. So, are there, looking at Revelations overview kind of thing, I assume that there are two ways to look at it. One is this this message to people that there's hope in the future. You know, I mean, there's a lot of troubled times and things to get through, you know, but there's salvation, whatever, at the end. So that's an uplifting theme, right? Now, so that's kind of a generalized kind of an approach. Now, you mentioned, I think, that in that one section of the Revelations, you know, there's this ungodly, beautiful woman riding this beast, and the woman is a Babylon, which in the book of Revelation, I think she was called Babylon. And but he said in reality, or you said that, oh, and the beast, I think, had seven horns, and that represented the seven hills of Rome, and she represented Rome. So that's kind of getting real specific, right? And is that appropriate?
Well,
to be specific in some areas, but the main message being just this world of plagues and punishments, you know, after this this lifetime and whatever centuries of punishments and plagues, there's heaven.
Well, I don't necessarily think, Jeanette, I don't think it needs to be an either or.
Right. That's what I'm asking.
Think that the two things that you just described, on the one hand, if you step back and look at the whole arc of the story and the whole theme of the story, what you get, some might interpret, I would interpret, as you get a story of hope, even in the midst of tribulation. Mm-hmm. Even in the midst of difficulty, even in the midst of violence. The end game is hope. And if you zoom in super close, you see all of these little details. And where I would go with the details is that every single detail had nuance and a richness of meaning that was perfectly understandable to the people at the time. They didn't need a translator. They didn't need an interpreter. Every single bit, they were like, oh, ha, 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 we see what you did there. That was a reference to so-and-so. That was a reference to this other thing. Ha! But Zoom 2000 years later, put in a different area of the world, and in a different culture, and in a different language. And it doesn't make much sense. Like, there's the occasional bit of, oh, I think I know what that means. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so then the question that we have when we interpret it is, okay, did John of Patmos intend this to be only for, like, the generation he was writing to? Like, literally, this is a message of hope and prophecy for the next 10 years, and then it expires. And really, stop trying to see into it after 10 years. That's, as an example, I picked 10 as a random number, a generation. Or did John of Patmos intend this to be a cosmological vision of all things everywhere? And if he did, was he correct in doing so? So
wouldn't that depend on whether you believe that he actually had this vision? And if he had the vision, then wouldn't it be, it was God's instruction, write this down and write it to the seven churches And so he was following orders. It wasn't so much his thought process that he was writing it for this group of people. It was God's message, getting God's message out to these particular people that he has some kind of power or influence with, even if he's in prison. And so to me, it seems like God has a message he wants people to hear, and he's using John for these particular churches. And when I went over this week, each one in, I think maybe it's chapter 2 and 3, where the he's told by the vision, whoever's speaking to him in the vision, which sounds like God, write this to the angel of the church of, and every single one of those churches, it's write this to the angel of the church of. So that gives you then a second layer of messengers, are the angels, right? He delivers it to the angel, he writes it for the angel, not for the church as such, which has a middleman messenger.
Right. And so you have just uncovered the next layer of complexity and interpretation. And the next layer of complexity is, what is the role of divine revelation in this document? And by that, you know, those are some fancy words, but by that, I mean, very specifically, John says, this is a revelation from an angel of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord spoke, and very frequently in prophecy, you'll see an angel speaking, but speaking with the voice of God. Like, you don't get to hear the voice of God. Very few people canonically in the Old Testament and the New Testament actually got to hear the voice of God and survive to tell the tale. We frequently get messengers who speak in the name of God, if you will. So anyway, so John tells us that he had a revelation and that an angel of the Lord came to him and gave him these series of messages for his particular churches and a really big vision that he was spiritually transported into and got to participate in and was asked questions and answers and got to see things and was prohibited from writing down only a very small little portion, very, very small, and then sent as a circular letter to these seven churches so that each one of them could hear. So that's what John says. And certainly, I think that we can trust that John had a mystical experience that we would not be able to categorize if he wasn't using drugs. I mean, if he was, okay, he was tripping. That's easy to categorize. We got a pigeonhole for that. We can shove it in real easy. Okay, but he wasn't using drugs, let's say. So if he's not using drugs, then is he psychotic? Did he have a break with reality? That's another pigeonhole that we have these modern days. Well, okay, well, maybe that's a possibility. We'll stick a possibility in there. What if he was just a mystic? Plenty of religious people talk to their God and hear some kind of response all the time. Okay, so maybe he was actually a mystic. One of the ways that all mystics have to wrestle, let me back up. One of the most important things every mystic has to wrestle with, and it's a constant thing, it's not a one and done thing, is what I am hearing truly the voice of God? And if I think it is what I am continuing to hear as I go along, continuing to be the voice of God? Because if we can presuppose that mystics exist, we acknowledge it, it's part of our irrational but true world. Mystics exist, and they speak to God, and God speaks back, Those are three separate things that we would have to accept as true. Then we also need to account for evil in our equation. So it's not just that mystics exist and they speak to God and God speaks back. It's that evil also exists and evil interferes in the lives of good and holy people. And so the other side of the question that mystics have to constantly ask, is this really God? Or is this whatever power and force of evil, I put a name to it? I'll call it for right now, the devil. So is this God or is this the devil?
Speaking to John.
And, you know, not everybody assumes these five things. Not everybody can even swallow that mystics really exist, that's a thing, that's real. Okay, well, if you don't believe that, then you don't have to worry about the other four. And if you don't believe that, then you don't have to worry about taking the revelation to John as a divine revelation. You can just put it in a pigeonhole of he was tripping on mushrooms, or he was having a psychotic break, and boy, howdy, he had one. You know, you can put it in some other rational pigeonholes, fine. But if we presume that mystics exist and that therefore divine revelation can exist, we also have to acknowledge the meddling, invasive, and pervasive nature of evil. And where I lay on this spectrum of how do we interpret this, given divine revelation as a real thing, is that this is not 100% divine revelation from the source of all good in the universe. I believe that this is some portion divine revelation from the source of all good in the universe, and some portion of demonic meddling from the source of all evil in the universe. It is not 100%, which is why I do not trust it 100%. Jesus, I trust 100%. Everybody else has got a little bit of the devil in them.
Interesting.
It gets tricky because divine revelation is not something that in most Protestant churches we hear a lot about from the pulpit. And it's tricky because we're in a scientific culture that highly values rationalism, even while we rationalize irrational choices all the time. It's a fun hobby for most of us to do. Where do you guys sit on this question? It's a thorny issue.
I don't know. I'm not sure I have any. I don't know. I can't say that I'm absolutely believe in the divine revelation, I guess. I don't, you know. I'm not sure. I just don't know. There's too many ifs and buts
and like you were saying,
I just kind of tend to take revelations with a huge grain of salt. It's what I do. It's, you know, it's a story. It's a story. You know, one of the things we forget is the Bible is full of stories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally stories, not, you know, man-made stories. Mm-hmm. So that have been produced and go on, you know, like in most cultures, there's stories that continue and continue. And in Christianity, I can't get too worked up about revelations, to tell you the truth. There's just too many ifs and buts, and I just don't know. I think it's an interesting story. I don't think it's predictive of anything. It doesn't scare me like it does some people. You know, I just think it's another story. So that's my take on it anyways.
And question is, Jeanette, and then Sue.
what was intended by the story, you know, what was intended either by God through the angel or just by John himself. I mean, stories have meanings and interpretations, so, you know.
That's true. I don't know. I'm not sure that John was too tightly wrapped, but you know, I don't know. There's no way of knowing, I guess, is what I'm really saying.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you're wacko nuts or you're psychotic. You know, people have delusions. I don't think every dream is anything that is profound or predictive or, you know what I mean? And yeah, our brains are pretty weird pieces of real estate for most of us. And, you know, this may well have been, if he was a person who had, as you say, he was, you know, he was banned for some reason. We don't know why. Maybe good, maybe bad. We don't know why he was sent off to Patmos to be by himself. But that alone is a, isolation is not a good thing for people. Isolation is not. It's the human being is designed to have contact. And I can't imagine what it might be like to be stuck somewhere by yourself. And your brain can do just wonderful things. I mean, we've all had that experience of having our brains wander off into really weird stuff.
So we've experienced that in this pandemic. I mean, there's been a lot of isolation and, trying to keep people separate, especially in the early days, you know, and it really did affect people.
It did. Oh, it does. No it question.
It is.
Lasting effect.
Mm-hmm.
And Sue, why don't
solitary
you
solitary confinement, for example, in yes, our own society.
Exactly. As I was going through my notes and rereading the book itself, I kept thinking, in line with both Donna and Jeanette, since ancient times, the way people taught before they had books and stuff was by oral storytelling. And it was a process where at certain points in their culture, they would gather together and the elder would tell the story, and the story was to teach a lesson. So I tried to figure out, as I was going through it the second time or third time, what specifically was I supposed to learn from this? Mm-hmm. And so when the seven angels were talking to he was writing to the seven angels about the seven churches, each message is literally almost identical in form, but the little teeny particulars are just slightly different. And so I made a listing of these. I just wanted to see what the heck was going on that was different about them. And so 3, 4, 5 of the seven churches were told to repent, but 3 of them were not. 3 of them were kind of, seemed to be sort of being told, you're not doing a bad job. Maybe you can do a little better, but you're doing fine. And 5 of them were told, shape up or ship out.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you read further, and so that was in chapter 2, I think, or 3. And then as you read through, this seems to be repeated in slightly different formats. Mm-hmm. That the message is repent and they don't, and mm-hmm. repent and they don't. And all the way through the 20 chapters, somebody's saying in one verse or another, repent. And then a few verses down, it says, and the people didn't. And so I'm thinking that maybe that was, you know, and this is just my own thought process in isolation in the pandemic. I keep thinking we do not let ourselves, and I'm just thinking of little personal bits and pieces of my own life, we don't we want to hold everybody else accountable, and we get very upset when other people don't hold the right people accountable, as in our current politics. But do we hold ourselves accountable? Do we?
Very good job.
Yeah. Do we, in the little things that we don't do right, do we accept the fact that, boy, I goofed that up. I really could have done a better job. I need to fix that. I need to make some kind of makeup thing to whoever it was that was hurt or insulted or whatever else I did.
Mm-hmm. And be more careful in the future.
Yeah. Pardon me?
And be more careful in the future.
You know, yeah, exactly. But sometimes there's a point that you actually have to step forward and say, I'm sorry, I really should not have this, that, or the other thing. But that takes a tremendous amount of personal courage to step out and go back to a person maybe weeks or months later and say, I don't know if I hurt you that much. I didn't mean to hurt you at all, and I shouldn't have said what I said.
So, Marilyn, you want to jump in on this?
I just had one thought. Do we know, or can we find out why and how this particular book, or even part of it, was chosen to be part of the Bible? Because they were just people who made the selection. And what reasoning did they use to put all of this in?
We've addressed this question a little bit before, and my answer is I don't know enough about the actual selection process for canon. Honestly, it's never been a topic that is wildly enthusiastic for my brain pan, but I do know that there are a couple of books of the New Testament that were contested during those conversations when they were closing canon and deciding what's in, what's out, and what's kind of on the fringe. Yeah, you know, it's we recognize that it's good, but we don't recognize that it's good for all people in all circumstances. And so what was generally put in had to come up to snuff in the sense that, yes, this we believe to be inspired by God and generally good for all people in all circumstances, like all walks of life, I mean. And there were two or three books of the Bible, and the Revelation to John was one of them, where there was heavy debate. It was not anything close to a unanimous vote. A lot of people are like, y'all are nuts, because they were like that a lot, the early Christians. They got into fistfights in the streets for the most interesting and fascinating reasons, like in the second and third century. And so it was contentious, and it was included.
Which other books were contentious?
I knew you were going to ask that. I don't recall immediately. It might come to me later, probably at 3 a.m.
Would they be like the Apocrypha?
You know, the ones that didn't get included, but that are in the Apocrypha, were deemed, oh, there's an official term, which of course I don't recall. I apologize. But they were deemed good and useful, but not necessarily essential to the faith. And so, you know, we acknowledge that they might be helpful for you to read. Go ahead and read them. But if you disagree about them, don't worry about it. They're not essential.
So Revelations was not put in the Apocrypha. It was put in the essential.
Right. Which is why it was a contentious vote. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, after having been through Revelations twice now, once with Vicki and once with you in a leadership role, I'm beginning to understand more about
about how it was, about what it was really about, and how it got to be what it got to be. But the message of it is one of hope that Jesus will return. And I would guess that that may be one of the reasons that our great and wise forefathers thought was important to, because it, you know, it is a message of hope. But the first time you read it, you think, this is just wacko nuts. You know, what is this about? Yeah. And you have to go through all of this, wade through a swamp of kind of craziness. And then finally you get to the end and you figure out that, yeah, this is a good thing. This was a good thing.
There are 20 chapters of plagues and punishments, and only 2 chapters of beautiful heavenly.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, the balance is not all that.
Nope.
Yeah.
As I said, it's a swamp-like thing to get to.
It is. And, you know, I am reminded that in the swamps, there are cranes and eagles and great beauty.
Right.
And there are alligators.
And snakes.
And water moccasins.
All kinds of nasty stuff. And beautiful.
And leeches.
Yep.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
I'm definitely glad that this is my first time reading Revelation in its entirety. And I'm very glad we did it. And I thank you for leading us through. So
Revelation.
Pardon?
Revelations is a revelation.
It is.
Yeah. One way or another.
But I believe that if we obey the God's 10 commandments and his word, we're all Christians and we all sin one way or another, but if we obey the commandments and do good in the world for other people and for the good of the world, there's your hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I think that is the essence of a good life. The essence of a good life. And it can also be twisted in very dark ways. You know, Jesus was all about, in his teachings and his preachings, the proper way to understand something. And he frequently taught against aspects of the Ten Commandments as frequently as he taught for aspects of the Ten Commandments. And I point you, not to chapter and verse because I'm terrible at that, but I point you to the incidents of his students breaking the Sabbath. They were wandering through and plucking heads of grain, and that was breaking the Sabbath. And when he was called on it, because, you know, the buck has to stop somewhere and it stops with the teacher, he's like, you know, you've missed the whole point of Sabbath. Sabbath was made for us humans. Humans were not created to idolize the Sabbath. And that was a mind-blowing interpretation at the time. Likewise, he preached that, you know, Moses has told you that you need to honor your mother and your father. But I tell you that if you follow this path that I am on, you're going to piss off everybody. It's going to set mother against daughter and daughter against mother. It's going to set son against father and father against son. So go into it with eyes wide open, because you're not going to be able to honor your mother and your father. Not in the ways they demand. When they make demands of you that your culture finds reasonable, but that Jesus finds unreasonable. Mm-hmm. So again, it's about interpretation. And so, sure, follow the Ten Commandments, live a good and righteous life. Absolutely. But if someone else is following the Ten Commandments in a way that you deem improper, it's not really up to you to judge. It's up to God to judge. What we need to do, as Jeanette and as Sue were saying, is in essence, keep our own nose clean. You know, have integrity to repent when we need to repent, to God and to those we have offended as well as we can. With the caveat that sometimes we can't. And so sometimes we can only repent to God.
Right.
And that is enough.
And one of the most hopeful parts of it, as I was rereading it, is the fact that it's not us to judge. It's not our world that judges us. I mean, obviously they do, but in the end, the only judgment that really is going to matter is God's. And who gets sealed and who gets protected and all of that, that's God's choice. It's not ours.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what we're going to do next? You know?
No, because I haven't had time to prepare it yet.
Oh, okay.
But thanks for offering. Is anyone else?
We had several choices, several things that were brought up. Like Grace mentioned doing James, the book of James, for example.
Right. So we're going to move forward and we're going to read together the book of James. Beginning the first Wednesday in February, we're going to take the next Wednesday off.
Mm-hmm. Brother and Sharon.
Yes, ma'am.
I have been praying for your sister. I would like to know what her name is.
Thank you. Her name is Rose.
Okay.
You should do it. Added to our prayer list. It took me a while to get that far, but it did get added.
Thank you.
When is her next surgery?
Her next surgery is, one moment, February 1st.
Oh.
So the day before that we leave. She's doing well. She's looking forward to the next surgery. And there's every hope that it will go well and that eventually it will make a difference. It'll take a couple of months for them to calibrate things. But
is the last surgery, or is she going to have to have more after that? Even
the last surgery for at least a couple of years.
Oh, good.
So, mm-hmm. Not sure what comes after that.
Yeah,
good. Nothing is decided.
One day at a time.
So, does anyone have a final thought or question or observation about our 22 chapter dive? Ancient prophecy.
A big thank you for doing it with us and your great advice and I love your mind.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's interesting, the perspective. Vicky's was in some ways similar, and it's always different with different people and different to work with it. And I think that's great. That's wonderful. I was not aware that your sister was ill. I must have missed that session when that came up. And I do have daily devotions, and I would like to add her name also to my daily devotions. What is the nature of her difficulty?
She has pretty severe epilepsy.
Ah, okay.
And so they have, at some point a few years ago, her medication stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, she's a professional in the world, and that's not great to suddenly have out of control epilepsy. Yeah. And still try to have a job and a life.
Exactly.
And so she recently had exploratory brain surgery. It's diagnostic. Which is why I have a shaved head. This is not fashion.
I thought it was a fashion statement myself.
No, and I'm in a very fuzzy place right now that I'm not really appreciating in an aesthetic sense. But anyway, so
it looks kind of cute.
So she, thanks.
There you go.
Yeah, you know, the military recruit. It was not the look I was going for.
Was the look you were going
Thank
for?
You. No. Anyway, so. She had some surgery done in December, and the next surgery is the recommended course of action And hopefully in about 6 months or 9 months, she'll be in a very different place.
Good.
And the epilepsy will be more under control. So
we will pray for her, you know, for her recovery.
Thank you very much.
What we're going to do next, after Grace's suggestion of the games, which I'm totally in support of, I'd like to do something in the Old Testament. So,
okay.
Whatever.
Well, and I also want to point out that at some point you're going to have a priest.
We are. Really? Really?
Oh, but we could keep going on as our, you know.
That's going to be a while.
As our adjunct Bible study person. You know.
Well, that is something that you will need to take to vestry members.
Take to vestry members.
Because that is something that the vestry members need to know is important to you. And that is something that will absolutely be at the discretion of your next rector.
Yes, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
We're a very small elder group.
Elder group.
We are to the next pastor. I mean, you and Vicki and Father Leon always made it a priority, but not everybody does, especially when it's a small little group. Right. We need to recruit.
Well, and you know, you can do that. And you can think about ways and means to do that. And you know, to be clear, your next priest may love leading Bible studies.
Yeah.
And might be very good at it with yet again another style. Yeah. And you may just think to yourself, well, Mother Sarah was great. And now we have the rector so-and-so. And they're great. So, you know, it's okay.
Yes. I know.
It's okay.
We'll get there eventually.
You will. You'll get there eventually.
We will.
All right. Then I will call this Bible study to a close. Thank you so much for joining me on our perilous trek. Right. Through the visions of Patmos. Right. And I will see you in 2 weeks to open up the letter to James. Well, the letter of James.
All right.
Sounds good.
Thank Farewell, you. Friends.
Thank Goodbye. You very much.
Bye. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.